Chapter 3. More Payback. Pasha wasn't gone for very long. He had left with Zephaniah the priest, but soon returned with some of my worst enemies and wearing a vindictive look on his face. He wasn't the ringleader, that was Shephatiah the son of Mattan, but he was definitely a willing accomplice. So was Jehukal, the grandson of the false prophet Hananiah, and the man behind my long incarceration in the house of Jonathan. Gedaliah the son of Pashur was in on it too, and they had the full authority of the king. It's hard to say much that is positive about Zedekiah as a king. He was a weak ruler from the start, and he never got any better. His friends ruled the roost, and he did what they told him to, except that he did have some boundaries he wouldn't let them cross. Not directly, at least. I was sitting at the reading bench against the wall of my room in the court of the guard, reading a scroll of Isaiah, and praying that Zedekiah would listen to the words God had just given him, when suddenly the door was flung open.
"There is Jeremiah the traitor," said one voice.
"He should die for his treason," said another.
I remember feeling the icy grip of fear tighten around my chest as I turned quickly to see Shephatiah and Jehukal already halfway across the room, running towards me. Gedaliah the son of Pashur and Pashur the son of Malchiah were close behind. I tried to stand, but I had barely started moving when Shephatiah grabbed me by the collar and yanked me backwards off the stool on which I had been sitting. As I fell, I remember thinking that this was the end. These men intended to kill me. My head hit the floor hard, and for some time I didn't really know what was going on, lying there helplessly as they ranted at me.
"How can we defend the city when people like you are telling everyone it is hopeless?" asked Shephatiah.
"Anyone who tells people to desert to the Chaldeans is fighting for the Chaldeans," said Pasha. "I say we should kill them," said Gedaliah.
"And that means we should kill you, Jeremiah," added Jehukal.
"You say that we'll all die by the sword, but it's you who ought to die," said Shephatiah.
There were many other complaints from them about what I had said in God's messages to the king, his household, and the people. But after a while, I noticed that all of their comments were that I should die, not that they were actually going to kill me. I wasn't about to jump up and celebrate, but it looked as if my end probably wasn't coming immediately. However, I soon realized from their subsequent comments that, although they weren't planning to kill me immediately, the plans they had would quickly lead to my death.
"We're going to put you into Prince Malchiah's cistern,"
Pashur informed me, with a cruel gleam in his eye.
"It doesn't have any water in it, so don't worry," said Gedaliah, laughing.
"And there probably aren't many rats either," added Shephatiah.
"Of course," said Jehukal, "you probably know that the last loaves of bread in the city have been used up today."
"And the king has ordered that you be fed with bread, hasn't he?" said Gedaliah.
"What a pity," said Jehukal.
"Don't worry, we'll give you all the bread we can find," said Pasha.
"Oh, yes," said Gedaliah sarcastically. "We must obey the king's commands, mustn't we?"
By that time, I was able to speak again at last.
"Did King Zedekiah tell you to do this?"
"More or less," said Shephatiah. "You know he hates you too."
"He said we can do whatever we want to do," said Jehukal.
I later found that this was only partly true. If they'd been given complete freedom, they would have killed me immediately. Zedekiah had just enough strength of character and care for me to refuse them that opportunity.
"So, why don't we go and do it now?" asked Gedaliah.
"Get up, old man," said Shephatiah roughly.
I sat up slowly, rubbing the back of my head, and winced as I touched a large swelling and felt the stickiness of blood oozing onto my fingers.
"Oh, look, he's hurt," sneered Jehukal.
"Of course he is with the way you two have treated him," said Pasha. "You didn't need to kick him, Jehukal."
That explained the pain in my ribs. It must have happened while I was recovering from the crack on the back of my head.
Pasha, you're too soft with him. Everyone is. That's why he causes so much trouble, said Shephatiah.
Then to me he said,
Get up now, traitor, or we'll have to drag you.
And once we start, we won't stop until we drop you into the cistern, head first, said Jehukal threateningly. Slowly I stood, with my hand pressed to the back of my head. Pasha stepped closer, as if he would have liked to have helped me, but didn't quite know how. Jehukal grabbed my left arm, and Shephatiah my right, and together they marched me out of the room and across to the stairs that led down into the lower levels of the palace. Gedaliah and Pasha were following, carrying torches, and with coils of rope hanging over their shoulders. The guards recognized my captors as the king's friends and accepted without question their explanation that the king had ordered them to put me into Malchiah's cistern on the lowest level of the palace. Malchiah was the king's son and had supervised the building of the cistern into which I was to be thrown. Water collected in the courtyard was directed down below the palace into the cistern through channels and pipes. It had been a dry winter followed by a hot spring, and as we stumbled our way down the poorly lit steps, I hoped that Gedaliah was right that there was no water in it. When we reached the bottom of the stairs, Gedaliah and Pasha lit the torches they were carrying. As they flared, the flickering light revealed shadowy shapes scurrying across the floor and along the channels that directed water into Malchiah's cistern. Quickly, and not gently, I was led across the floor to a dark hole.
"Jump in," said Shephatiah.
"No," I said. "Why not?" asked Jehukal with a harsh laugh. "There's no water in there." They seemed to delight in mocking me.
"Stop it, you two," said Pasha. "You know that we brought the ropes for lowering him down, so let's get on with it."
"But he might be too heavy," said Jehukal.
"Yes, we might slip and drop him," agreed Shephatiah.
They were obviously trying to frighten me, and it was working all too well. Pasha removed the rope that was hanging over his shoulder and threw one end to Shephatiah, then held up his torch. The light shone down into the dark hole, and I caught a glimpse far below, not of water, but of a dark, evil-looking mud. I wondered who had come up with this way of getting rid of me. And did they plan to start lowering me and then deliberately let go of the ropes? Gedaliah did the same with his rope, and soon the two ropes were stretched across the hole with a man at each end. I looked desperately around for any way of escape, but my persecutors always seemed to make sure that there were at least two of them between me and the steps leading up to the surface.
"Don't even think about it," warned Shephatiah. "If you try to run away, we really will throw you in without any ropes."
"And enjoy doing it," said Jehukal. "You don't need to say that," said Pasha.
"Oh, let's stop the endless talking and get him in there," said Shephatiah angrily.
He forced me to sit down on the side of the hole between him and Jehukal, then took the rope he was holding and put it under my right arm.
"Keep it there," he said. "Don't let it fall, or you might fall too."
"Hold this one under your other arm," said Jehukal, passing it under my left arm as he spoke, "and don't drop it either." "Slide slowly off the edge," said Gedaliah. "We'll keep the ropes tight and lower you down." I held the ropes as instructed and tried to slide off the edge while the four of them stood up above me, holding the ropes tight, ready to take the load. After a few tries, I at last worked up the courage to really slide off, and found myself hanging just below the level of the floor in almost total darkness. The torches had been placed in holders on the walls, and little of their light made it down into the cistern. I was lowered down gradually, unable to tell either how far I had come or how far I had to go. Finally, my sandals touched something, and soon my legs were sinking in a foul-smelling mud that seemed eager to swallow me whole. As they continued to lower me, I continued to sink, wondering all the time just how deep the mud was. Did they know how deep the mud was? It was all very well to have no free water in the cistern, but if the mud was deep enough, they wouldn't need any water to drown me. The mud would do the job well enough. I continued to sink until, with the mud up to my shoulders, my feet finally touched the bottom of the cistern. The ropes went loose, and Shephatiah said,
"He's down at the bottom. Pasher and Gedaliah, drop your ends of the rope and we'll pull the ropes up."
What I assumed were two ends of the ropes fell down on me, but of course I couldn't see them in the darkness.
"Get the ropes out from under your arms, Jeremiah,"
said Shephatiah as he started to pull them up. I couldn't do it quickly enough, and the ropes quickly began to burn and cut into my armpits as they were tugged from above.
"Slow down,"
I cried out in pain.
"We're in a hurry, you old fool,"
said Shephatiah savagely. "It's cold down here. We want to get up into the sunlight," added Jehukal. So they drew the ropes out of the pit, raising them as quickly as they could. I did my best to avoid the injury they were trying to inflict, but I wasn't very successful.
"Well, we're off,"
said Shephatiah, once the ropes had been hauled up and coiled.
"We'll leave you to think about all the people in the city whom you have been betraying with your coward's talk," said Jehukal, "and we won't be coming back to feed you."
"Sorry, Jeremiah," said Pasher, "but there's no more bread in the city, and you are getting just what you deserve."
I could hear the sound of the torches being collected, then the light flickered and faded as they started up the stairs. I was alone in the silence. The darkness was complete, and Jehukal was right. It was cold. I tried to lean into the mud, but instead I began to sink under it. I wouldn't be able to lean or sit. All I could do was to stand, or I would die, engulfed and drowned by the mud. Maybe death was not far away. I was already beginning to shiver, and in this cold I wouldn't last long. My head was pounding, and my ribs were hurting too. The lowering by rope hadn't helped the pain inflicted by Jehukal's foot. But hadn't God promised me? I pushed that thought away because I was no longer sure exactly what God had promised me. But the thoughts kept coming back. Had I truly been given a guarantee of survival? After all, everyone has to die eventually. Or had I just been given a promise that they could not overcome me for as long as God intended me to survive? Time passed. It always does. But I had no way of telling how much time was passing. There was nothing to do except to pray and continue to stand. I tried moving across to the wall of the cistern, but found that it didn't work very well because the floor sloped upwards quite steeply. It began to take me out of the mud, but became too slippery to hold me up, and I slid back down into the mud. As I slipped, though, my foot knocked against a raised section of the floor of the cistern. Maybe it was harder rock that had proved too hard to excavate. I suppose that the reason doesn't really matter. What mattered was that when I stood on that raised area, the mud was only a bit more than waist deep. In relief and hope, I tried to sit down, but it was still too deep. The only advantage was that I was slightly warmer, not being completely surrounded by unpleasantly cold mud, though it still caked my upper body. But the truth was that my case was still completely hopeless. How could I rest or sleep when I couldn't even sit down?
What was I waiting for? Shouldn't I just give up and die? If I just sat down, the mud would take away all the trouble that my life had become. After all, I was nothing but trouble to everybody, and nobody cared about me. However, I have said it before, and it was true on this occasion too, I didn't quite know how to give up. God had not said that my work was finished, and anyway, what if the promise really was a promise? More than that, wasn't God's word a command? He had made me like an iron pillar and bronze walls, and had told me that I must not allow myself to be dismayed before them. Maybe it was his strength that was stopping me from giving up. If so, what was going to happen to save me? I didn't know it, but God had planned everything out through a brave eunuch from Ethiopia. He was a servant of the king, and I knew him a little. Why would a foreigner listen to Yahweh more than the people of Judah would? Yet he did, and God used his courage to save my life. As I struggled just to survive through that endless night, coming closer and closer to exhaustion and death, God was working for my salvation. Later on, Ebed-Melech, his name just means the king's servant, that's how unimportant he is, told me what he did when he heard the news about me being thrown into the cistern. It's an amazing story, and his courage was amazing too. I got him to write it down in his own words, since I don't really remember much of what happened when he came to rescue me. I was too exhausted. Ebed-Melech's story. It wasn't until the day after it happened that I heard how Jeremiah had been dumped into Prince Malchiah's cistern. I was furious, but what could I do? Logic told me I couldn't do anything, but my mind kept insisting that I had to try. I tried to get out of it, but after lots of arguing inside, I was finally convinced that I didn't have any choice. I was walking up towards King Zedekiah's throne room when I met one of his guards. He's a bit of a friend of mine, Jehonathan is, and I asked him if I could speak to King Zedekiah. I confess that, by that time, I was starting to get cold feet. After all, complaining to a king about his friends is a dangerous game to play, but my mind kept insisting. You may be wondering whether it's really that easy to get to see the king, and to be honest, it normally isn't. But my friend was on his way to deliver a message to King Zedekiah, and he told me to come along. At the time, Zedekiah was actually in the area near the Benjamin Gate of the city, hearing some legal cases or something. On the way there, I explained my mission to Jehonathan, and he stopped in mid-step and looked at me long and hard. "Are you mad?" he asked quietly. "Being a champion of Jeremiah is not the way to fame at the moment." "I know," I said, "but I can't just let them get away with it, can I? I like Jeremiah, and he really does seem to tell the truth from Yahweh. And I don't like seeing these young upstarts picking on a man of God who's twice their age." He mused, as he tapped the rolled-up message against the shaft of his spear. If Zedekiah is letting his friends persecute Jeremiah, I don't think he's likely to listen to a servant like you. I have to try. It's just not fair. "Well, it's your funeral, I suppose," said Jonathan, and we walked on. I wished he had chosen a different idiom. Hoped he wasn't going to be right. We walked on and joined the crowd, and I started to think exactly what I was going to say to the king. After a few minutes, the case finished. I think it was an accusation of stealing food, and a man was dragged away in chains. Then my friend Jehonathan moved towards the king, holding up his message, and I followed close at his heels. He handed over the message to the king, who started to open it, but then paused and looked inquiringly at me. My dark skin tends to attract attention here in Jerusalem. There aren't many of us Ethiopians around.
"He wants to talk to you about Jeremiah," said Jehonathan. The king started and looked around him quickly. A guard standing nearby had also reacted and was looking interested. "Irijah," said Zedekiah, beckoning, "go and make sure that the prisoner for the next case is ready." Irijah moved away towards the guard room of the gate, and Zedekiah seemed to relax a little. "What do you want?" he asked me. While standing in the crowd, I had worked out a fine-sounding speech that would convince King Zedekiah to free Jeremiah, but standing there before the king, I couldn't remember any of those beautiful words at all. "My lord, Shephatiah, Gedaliah, Jehukal, and Pasher have done evil in throwing Jeremiah into Malchiah's cistern. He'll die of hunger there in the mud. There's no bread left in the city, and sure as eggs is eggs, they won't be lowering down any bowls of soup for him." Zedekiah looked around again, but there was no one nearby listening. It's amazing how sometimes you can be almost alone in a crowd. "So that was what they planned," he said, drumming with the fingers of his right hand on his knee and not looking very pleased. He leaned forward and said to me quietly, "You're Ebed-Melech, aren't you?" I nodded, amazed that he knew my name. King Zedekiah is really quite a nice person if you keep him away from his friends, but a man chooses his friends. "I think you're right," he continued. "I thought that they would just lock him up, but I should have known better. All right, take 3 men. Jehonathan here can get another couple of men to help you. Then get Jeremiah out of the cistern as quickly as you can, preferably before my friends hear anything about it." He looked over his shoulder and saw Irijah returning with an unhappy-looking prisoner. "Go now," he said urgently, "and Jehonathan, choose your helpers carefully. Don't tell anyone else what is happening until you have Jeremiah safe. Give him a room in a quiet area of the court of the guard, out of the dungeons." By this time, Irijah was almost upon us, and Zedekiah looked at us almost apologetically before turning back to him and starting to discuss the next case. Irijah was looking at us curiously, but it was now a curiosity tinged with anger, as if he somehow guessed what we were doing and didn't like it. Jehonathan and I turned and walked towards the palace, and on the way I asked him, "Who is Irijah, and why is he so interested in Jeremiah?" "Irijah is a bitter enemy of Jeremiah's," said Jehonathan, "and he would be rejoicing if he knew where Jeremiah is at the moment. Maybe he does. He's always carrying on about trying to get Jeremiah." "Why does he hate Jeremiah?" I asked. Here was yet another enemy I could be making. "Irijah's grandfather Hananiah was a prophet," Jehonathan answered, "a false prophet. A few years ago he contradicted Jeremiah's prophecies and said that the king of Babylon would be defeated and that all of the treasures taken from the temple would be brought back to Jerusalem within 2 years. It never happened, of course, but that wasn't the main point. A week or two later, Jeremiah said that he had been given a message from God saying that Hananiah had been telling lies while proclaiming they were prophecies from God. He said that Hananiah would die before the end of the year. And get this," Jehonathan stopped and grabbed my arm, "Hananiah was dead within weeks." He let go of my arm and we walked on as he continued, "Irijah blames Jeremiah. Funny, really, because he keeps saying that Jeremiah is telling lies. Now, I would have thought that if he didn't believe Jeremiah, he wouldn't have believed he had the power to kill his grandfather either. Anyway, that's Irijah for you. Just a year or so ago, he managed to get Jeremiah beaten and locked up for a while, but the king freed him that time too. If you want my advice, I'd say watch out for Irijah and his friends, and Shephatiah and his friends too," he added dryly. By this time we were back at the palace, and Jehonathan went to the barracks where the king's guard lived to fetch another couple of men to help, while I went to the storehouse where all the unused items from the palace are stored. I fetched some old rags and worn-out clothes from there, as well as some ropes. Then I went downstairs towards the lowest levels of the palace, the parts that were used as a prison. When I came to the deepest, darkest level, I found Jehonathan already there with a couple of his friends. I was glad that they had thought to bring torches, because without them we wouldn't have seen much. Even so, it was almost as if the darkness was swallowing up the fitful light of the torches, and the gaping hole in the floor seemed to ooze blackness. A shallow gutter ran across the floor to the lip of the hole, with a few stones lying across it here and there, part of trying to keep rubbish out of the cistern, I guess. Beside one of the stones I saw what looked like a dead, desiccated rat, but it was hard to tell in the gloom. I didn't look too carefully. If these were the sorts of things flowing down towards the cistern, I wondered what items had got past the stones and were down there in the cistern with Jeremiah. More than just mud, I was sure. Again, I felt sorry for Jeremiah in his predicament and angry with the men who continued to persecute him. "Jeremiah," I called, leaning over the dark opening and straining to see anything in the inky depths. I couldn't see anything at all, so I was rather glad when I heard his response. "Is that you, Ebed-Melech? Oh, thank Yahweh. I never thought to hear anyone's voice again. I had given up hope." His muffled voice sounded tired, and there was none of the hope that normally enlivened his voice. "You're not going to die this time, Jeremiah," I replied. "The king has sent us here to get you out of there." "How long have I been in here? It's so dark in here. I can't see whether it is day or night," he croaked. "What time is it?" "It's the middle of the afternoon, and as far as I can tell, you've been in there since yesterday morning. So let's get you out of there quickly." I took one of the ropes and gave it to Jehonathan. "You take this rope with one of your friends and lower it down to Jeremiah." One of the men looked a little doubtful in the flickering torchlight. "Is that really Jeremiah, the son of Hilkiah, down there?" he asked, and he looked at Jehonathan accusingly. "You never told me we were going to help him. He's a traitor, isn't he?" "No, he's not," answered Jehonathan. "You can't believe everything you're told, you know. Who said he was a traitor?" "Well, it was Pasha and Irijah," the man replied. "They said he is encouraging people to betray us to the Babylonians." "No, he isn't," I said. "Jeremiah is just telling people that God says we are going to lose this war anyway, and that if we give in quietly, we'll be treated well. But if we keep fighting, we will still lose, and everything will be worse for everyone. That's not being a traitor, that's trying to help." "Yeah, well," said the other, "I'm finding it a bit hard to tell the difference. We're in the army to fight, and he's telling everyone to give up. That doesn't sound very patriotic." "He's been saying the same sorts of things for a long time now, you know. And he gets things right, too. He said the Babylonians would come, and they did. 40 years ago he started saying they would come, and at the time everyone laughed at him because no one could imagine Pharaoh letting Babylon run wild in his neck of the woods. But then Nebuchadnezzar came along, and people stopped laughing. Then just a couple of years ago, when the army of Pharaoh started to advance towards us, Nebuchadnezzar took his army away from our walls for a while. Everyone yelled and cheered and rejoiced, but Jeremiah said Nebuchadnezzar would come back with his army, and he was right again. And what about Irijah's grandfather, too? Look, if God says that Nebuchadnezzar is going to conquer Jerusalem, surely it's pretty stupid to keep fighting? But that's what your bosses want you to do. If they would just give in, as Jeremiah says, lots more of you soldiers would stay alive." It was a long speech. I don't normally talk very much, but sometimes things need to be said. Our leaders, even King Zedekiah, are all too concerned about their own skins and don't seem to care about anyone else's. Anyway, in this case the speech managed to convince Jehonathan's friends enough that they helped us to lower the ropes down to Jeremiah. By that time, my eyes had got more used to the darkness, and I could see that he was up to his waist in wet, slimy mud. We dropped down some old clothes to him, and at my insistence he put some of them between his arms and the ropes. I had a suspicion that the mud would not want to let him go, and that we would have to pull pretty hard to lift him out. And so it proved. It wasn't thin, runny mud, nor was it thick, firm earth. It was mud into which you would pretty quickly sink, and then you'd be stuck there. We started to lift him, but soon realized that meant trying to lift all of the mud out of the bottom of the cistern as well. We pulled and we pulled, but we weren't getting far, and it was clear that the ropes were cutting into Jeremiah quite badly. After a while, Jehonathan told Jeremiah to kick his legs around, and that did the trick. With various sucking and slurping noises, the mud finally let him go, and he was left dangling in mid-air with bits of mud falling off him. When we got him up to floor level, he really looked a mess, covered with mud from head to foot and looking utterly exhausted. I'm not sure how much longer he would have lasted in that cistern if we hadn't come when we did. You can't get much sleep when you're waist-deep in slimy mud that will drown you if you don't keep your head up. And he was cold, too. He was shivering and shaking when we finally helped him up over the edge so that he could collapse on the floor. Poor Jeremiah. We took him out of those gloomy depths and led him up to ground level, where we helped him to clean himself up a bit. I insisted that he eat my lunch. There's precious little of any sort of food left in the city, so he wouldn't have got anything otherwise. Then, as the king had commanded us, we put Jeremiah into a room where he would feel safe and could recover from his ordeal. You know, God expects a lot from his servants, particularly when it involves trying to warn others and save their lives. Yahweh cares, and he wants his worshippers to care too. I must admit, though, I find it hard to care for people like Shephatiah, Gedaliah, Jukal, and Pashur. So God did protect Jeremiah after all, but it's a bit funny that he should have done so through me, a foreigner and a slave, when there are so many members of his chosen people who could have done the job. Maybe that is one of the reasons why Jerusalem is to be destroyed.